Argue, argue, talk, 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 exaggerate, argue, pontificate, argue, just talk, shut talk, up. Talk, why won't you listen? Argue, why won't shut, you see? I know the story, just listen to me. Talk.
You're better off when you're spouting off. And now, here's your host, Karen Cataline.
Well, and welcome to Spouting Off. Karen Cataline with you on a Tuesday, February 19th. This is our 59th show. Sometimes I like to say that because I just want you to know what number show it is. There is an enormous amount in the news today, and I have a lot to spout off about with you this afternoon. If you'd like to join in the first half hour, because I have a wonderful guest in the second half hour, which I'll tell you about in just a minute. But if you'd like to join the conversation, now would be a good time. You don't even have to wait for what I have to say. Maybe you have something to spout off about. The number is 888-627-6008. 888-627-6008. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I could tell you all hell broke loose, but it seems always to be breaking loose these days. I have several items, short, long, and in between, that I want to talk to you about. This one is one that I'm going to start off with simply because it is so frustrating. Before I get into some of the stuff I've been writing about, pontificating about, oh my goodness, I happen to find this item. The statue called the Unconditional Surrender Statue, which part of the reason that I am interested in this is because I saw it in person or in statue in Sarasota, Florida. It is a massive sculpture in a park in Sarasota, Florida, called the Unconditional Surrender. And it depicts a very, very famous image of World War II, of a sailor kissing a woman in a nurse's uniform in Times Square at the end of World War II. And it was vandalized yesterday, Monday, just a day before the veteran in the photo, George Mendoza, died at the age of 95. They found him, and it turns out to have been him. And here's just the most, it tells us so much about some of the problems and some of the difficulties that we are facing here in 2019 America. And I'm going to be talking about that in this first half hour. Vandals spray painted hashtag Me Too. Can you imagine? Me Too. On the Unconditional Surrender statue in Sarasota, Florida, yesterday, said the Sarasota Police Department. And they show a picture, although it's been cleaned up now, they show a picture of somebody spray painting that. This statue is so enormous that probably, I'm just guessing, a human being, a normal-sized human being, might go up to her knee. That's how huge this statue is. And it is a beloved statue. And because of the ignorance and the stupidity and the lack of knowledge of history, some idiot paints hashtag Me Too on that statue. So at the end of World War II, when the so-called greatest generation, that's my parents' generation, sacrificed and fought and made sure that we could defeat Nazism, albeit we got into the war awfully late, so that my people wouldn't be murdered by genocide and America wouldn't be speaking German. It is true that that soldier grabbed a nurse who was a total stranger to him, as I remember, and and a photographer snapped that picture. And it turned out to be the iconic picture of the end of the war. And it's called Unconditional Surrender. And some jerk spray painted Me Too on it because he was kissing the woman. That, ladies and gentlemen, is ignorance and stupidity. It's one thing to be ignorant. It's quite another, as I've said before, to be arrogant about it. This person, I'll bet you anything, had no clue what that statue commemorates, what that statue is all about, and what a joy of a memory it has been to so many. And yet they take something pathetic, politicized, and ridiculous, overgeneralized groupthink of Me Too to debase that statue. We're living in a time where statues to fallen heroes and police officers get debased. So why should I be surprised? I'm not. I'm just saddened by it. It isn't just the act of vandalism. It's the ignorance, the lack of knowledge and appreciation for an era different than their own. And this brings to mind the statues that have been brought down because they depict a piece of history that some leftist indoctrinated skull full of mush doesn't like. If we didn't have statues to remember historic times, whether we like them or not, then, as the famous phrase goes, we are doomed to repeat it. Well, the people that try to deface statues that are history, that are part of our American history, good, bad, and ugly, and mostly so much better than the hard left would have us believe, if they can do that, then they're basically saying that they know better than anybody down through history. And the pathetic part is that they know nothing. They know absolutely nothing. I am not as knowledgeable about history as I would like to be. I've developed certainly an interest in it. I had no interest in it in high school. You know, I had one terrific history teacher and one really horrible history teacher who actually made American history boring. He didn't know how to teach it. If you can make American history boring, you're doing something wrong. So anyway, that statue has now been restored and repainted, I presume. It's hard to get red paint off her white leg but below the knee, but I'm appalled. And we got to do a better job. I know that's just a very broad general statement. Got to do a better job of educating the young about what made this country great. To that end, the next important issue that I wrote about and published a blog post about this morning. I'm going to pull it up here just because I can. I'm going to pull it up. So we had, in the last 2 days, we've had a story that has dominated the news about an unknown actor by the name of Jussie. I assume that's short for Justin Smollett. Justin Smollett, who went public with what we now know, or what the police are now telling us. I mean, nobody ever waits for stories anymore. They just jump right in and impose their political agenda on whatever. And that is what they do to everything. The name of the piece that I wrote this morning on the blog currently is, "Why Are False Accusers So Often Leftists?" So this actor, Jussie Smollett, if you've been living under a rock, accused two white men of attacking him because he was black and he was gay. Oh my God, another victim. He said they were white. He said they were wearing MAGA hats. Make America Great Again hats. And he said, this is, and they said, MAGA country. This is MAGA country. And then proceeded to call him all kinds of names. What is amazing about this, as the story comes out, that in fact it was two black, I think Nigerian immigrants who he knew and paid and who had worked as extras on his silly, stupid TV show that only a handful of people know. Not that there's anything wrong with that, to be doing a show, a radio show, a TV show that isn't well known. That isn't the problem. What is the problem is that Jussie decided that he was going to attack himself, and he was dumb enough to wanted to put it on camera, and the camera was facing the wrong direction. That's just by way of explanation. What I want to know is, if America is such a racist country, if we are a country full of racist bigots, homophobes, and the like, which, by the way, Bernie Sanders easily calls Donald Trump and all of his supporters in his announcement today that he is once again at the age of 78 running for president. But if the country is so full of these people, why do leftists have to keep making stuff up? Why is that? I mean, most people who saw that story were scratching their heads saying, what? What are you talking about? That's the silliest thing I've ever heard. I mean, first of all, this guy is not a well-known actor. So who exactly attacked him? He obviously has an exaggerated sense of his own self-importance. But it brings to mind something else that I've been looking at and watching for a very long time. And the term is from the French. And the term is called agent provocateur. I never spell it right. Every time I spell it, I gotta look it up. The French pronunciation or spelling, the last word is provocateurs. So agents provocateur. And here's the definition: a secret agent hired to incite suspected persons to some illegal action outbreak that will make them liable to punishment. All right, so that is a related kind of false accusation in which people try to provoke guilt in an innocent person for the purposes of politics. Now, a related incident or a related thing is when people victimize themselves so that they can be seen as victims in the press and so that they can gain the upper hand politically and otherwise. As a formerly practicing social worker, I find it fascinating that people want to be victims so badly that they are willing to fake their own victimization in order to play that role of victim. And in the case of Jussie Smollett, who is an actor, he did a reasonably good job of acting the victim. And he had a highly a press that was willing to go along with his story. God forbid they should ever have asked him a tough question or to have questioned this story before reporting it. We had presidential candidates, a long list of them, who called the whole thing a modern day lynching because they believe this about America. And they're actually happy to see what they think is evidence of it. Do you think for one minute that they will be changed a little bit to see that what they believe in this case isn't true? No. I predict that they're going to double down on their contention that America is a racist country. And, oh, it's just so too bad that Jussie Smollett smeared their wonderful clean movement. The fact of the matter is they believe that any accusation of a conservative or of a Trump supporter should be believed automatically. No questions asked. These people are not journalists. These are propagandists. And I don't think that this is going to change them one bit. What I think it could change, however, and what I hope it will change, however, is a greater number in the public than ever before, seeing that they've been sold a bill of goods. And it's a weak position to have to sit back and go, gosh, I really hope people begin to understand that they are being hoodwinked. They are being scammed. They are being hoaxed. Is that a verb? Hoaxed? I hoax, you hoax. This is a hoax, ladies and gentlemen. And there is a long list. If you pull up my blog post called How Come It's Leftists Who Are Always the False Accusers, there are some hot links that will tell you just some of the examples, just some of the many, many examples of things that have been done certainly before Donald Trump, but a whole lot after Donald Trump in order to smear Donald Trump. Now, a logical thinking person is going to ask themselves, now, wait a minute. If there's a flurry of, say, anti-Semitic or anti-Black incidents in this country, does that automatically mean that Donald Trump is culpable? Well, believe it or not, in the leftist world of insanity, it does mean that. And so right after Donald Trump's amazing and unlikely win of the President of the United States, there was a flurry of, for example, swastikas that were painted in strange places. And they weren't even painted correctly because we're back to the ignorance of vandals and young leftists who have been untaught American history. And it's been replaced with socialism. But there were a lot of swastikas painted. And what did that give the media the opportunity to do? You see, anti-Semitic incidents are more prevalent than ever because of that evil Donald Trump. That's a pretty neat trick, considering that the greatest anti-Semites today, Jew haters, haters of Israel, haters of the Jewish people in general, happen to be the left. So it's interesting how they can flip back and forth between being appalled at anti-Semitism, which they incite, and then turning right around and starting the BDS movement and boycotting Israel because Israel's trying to defend herself and her sovereignty. It's a crazy world we live in. I'll tell you that. It's a crazy, crazy world. So there have been lots of incidences of false accusations. We were told to believe that Christine Blasey Ford should be believed simply because she was a woman. And of course, what follows is Black people should be believed simply because they're Black. And gay people should be believed simply because they're gay. I actually remember talking to someone who I disagreed with and who I wanted to have on the program, and she ended up hanging up on me. I haven't ever told this story. It's kind of funny. And not long after the Christine Blasey Ford debacle, in which she tried to falsely accuse Brett Kavanaugh with no evidence, and in fact, the opposite corroborating evidence, that's only one of the most high-profile false accusations. This young Black leftist that I wanted to have on, who is a supporter of Black Lives Matter, she kept expressing an opinion and then saying that she needed to be believed. And because I challenged her on that and said, wait a minute, that's a personal opinion. It's not a matter of belief. It's your belief, but it's not it's not a story that I have to decide that is true or false. It amazes me that the left has not been taught any of this critical thinking. I really shouldn't say that it amazes me that much, because in order to put back such evil ideas such as socialism, you have to dumb them down first. And it's nobody's fault really than the sleeping Republicans who've been asleep at the switch when it has come to education. And now we're seeing the real results of horribly ignorant and a lack of education of American history, of our Constitution. I mean, how can you really argue with the Constitution if you don't know what's in it? Maybe they'd have to pass it so they'll know what's in it, like Nancy Pelosi says. I don't know. There's another point I wanted to make in this piece. I hope I fully developed that enough so that you follow me in what I'm talking about this Black Lives Matter chick. It is amazing that at the same time that they can be racists, not blacks in general, but leftists, they can claim victimhood because you don't believe them for stating an opinion. Isn't it amazing? I mean, you can lump together an opinion, a personal opinion, with whether you are presenting facts in a story. And when she said that, it was such an enlightenment to me. I really understood the lack of her education to be able to say, I need to be believed like Blasey Ford needed to be believed, because she's stating a subjective opinion. It's just important for me to make that clear, because it is so amazing that that is who many of our opponents are. There's another point I wanted to make. As I was writing about this and the Jesse Smollett case and the perennial, ubiquitous, and repetitive accusations that the left makes about the right and conservatives and Republicans and Trump supporters and white people and Christians and straight males, that we're all just a bunch of racist, sexist, homophobe bigots. And that's pretty much what Bernie Sanders said when he was first interviewed, that he is again running for president. Trump is a racist, sexist, homophobe. It's amazing how quickly that rolls off people's tongues. And so I felt compelled. I wasn't like trying to defend my position, but I thought it was important to make it clear that I wasn't implying that real examples of bigotry no longer exist. But what is very interesting, and which I added to this piece later on because, you know, it was easy, I was able to kind of beef it up a little bit, is that the left has so politicized the whole idea of prejudice and bigotry and exaggerated these issues for political gain, that a whole lot of people seem to have forgotten that being a bigot isn't against the law. I know that's a radical idea, isn't it? Being a bigot isn't against the law, nor should it be against the law. That's a thought. It's not an action, it's a thought. Now, if you commit a crime and you do something against the law, and you act on your own prejudice in an unlawful way, like attacking or harassing or whatever, then you have a crime of varying degrees, right? But the left has been working overtime trying to criminalize thoughts instead of actions. Let me say that again. The left has been working overtime to criminalize thoughts instead of actions. They want you to think that being a bigot, for example, is worse than, say, killing two people, as in the case of O.J. Simpson. That's when I remember this really got this absurd notion was starting to really catch on. Now, being a bigot can be anything. It means to have a prejudice. You know, you could be a You could be prejudiced about not dating men with brown shoes, for example. And, you know, if the universe teaches you differently, or somebody doesn't like you because you've shown that you're prejudiced against certain people, so be it. But this whole notion that being a bigot is worse than murder, is worse than rape, is worse than anything. The Republicans have not fought against this because they've been so bullied and so completely flattened by being called a racist, a bigot, a homophobe, that this has gone unchallenged. And I'm quite concerned about it, because that's how they gain a foothold. That's how the left continually plays this game and gains more and more power. So we have to be on the lookout on that, for that, for the simple reason that we have a huge string of socialists, not all of them have even announced for president, who are running for office. Sanders, here's a headline for you. Headline: Sanders says 2020 campaign is about transforming our country. Where have we heard that before? Wait a minute. Didn't we have a guy who wanted to fundamentally transform our country? And that's one of the biggest reasons we have Donald Trump today. And despite the leftist media narrative, which is completely false, fake accusations, by the way, before I cut for a break, I'm going a little long here. The biggest false accusation, and the biggest one that must be debunked, along with all the rest, including arrest and prosecution for those who falsely accuse others of what they themselves have done, is the Mueller investigation itself. The Mueller investigation itself is one giant false accusation, one giant framing of our president. Not framing like the framers, but framing our president for crimes which they themselves committed. And for the last 2 years, we've been watching this travesty unfold. Donald Trump has more patience than I do, because Donald Trump, I believe, has allowed a lot of this to unfold so that the entire public could see how dishonest people are. Maybe that's optimistic. The truth remains to be seen. But in making his announcement that he's running again for president, Bernie Sanders, who was an independent before, now he's come out of the closet like all the rest as a, quote, democratic socialist. There's another word for a democratic socialist. It's called a socialist. That's what they are. They're socialists. And here's a quote I'll leave you with. Let me see if I can find it. Oh, I love this one. I think the current occupant of the White House is an embarrassment to our country. And he's not. Donald Trump is no embarrassment to our country. I think he is a pathological liar. I also think he is a racist, a sexist, a homophobe, a xenophobe, somebody who's gaining cheap political points by trying to pick on minorities, often undocumented immigrants. I don't have time to unpack that one, but he decides the dictionary, right? No, they're illegal aliens. That is their legal term. And the media has, in some circles, succeeded in turning a person who was never called a racist in his life as the biggest racist, sexist, homophobe there is. It's nonsense. It's stupid. And we better start calling it out. False accusers need to be prosecuted. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves in a world of hurt. When we come back, I will have the pleasure of interviewing my friend, smart, smart guy. You're going to want to stay tuned for this. Rob Nadelson, constitutional lawyer and fellow at the Independence Institute. He's going to tell us what he's up to, including Article 5 of the Constitution. You may or may not know what that is, so stay tuned. And we'll be right back on Spouting Off right after this.
Do you have a secret that's been bothering you? Have you been wondering if what you're thinking or feeling is normal? Is there someone with whom you've needed to clear the air, but you haven't been able to find the right words? Sometimes you need an objective, second opinion to help you see your problem more clearly. Ask Aunt Emma, and she'll help you move past what's getting in your way. She's a former therapist who is wise and caring, but instead of therapy, she'll give you terrific advice. It's free to ask Aunt Emma and explain your need, problem, or question. If you both agree, you pay only $1.39 a minute. It's anonymous, it's confidential, and you'll be surprised at how effective it is. You can ask Aunt Emma by going to facebook.com/askauntemma. There, you'll find her phone number and extension number. That's facebook.com/askauntemma. Ask Aunt Emma today.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. It's a community of like-minded people who work together to pay for their medical costs. You choose your doctor and hospital, starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. For more info, visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
Hi, I'm Shelby, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Yarn, on Congress granting itself legal exemptions.
In 1788, as the Constitution was being debated, James Madison wrote that the chief restraint preventing Congress from passing laws that apply to us, but not to Congress, is, quote, "the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom. If this spirit shall ever diminish so as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature, the people will be prepared to tolerate anything but liberty. Today, Americans live under many laws that do not apply to elected officials and those who work for them. If we hope to preserve our liberty, we must recultivate that manly spirit of freedom that our fathers had."
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
All right. Welcome back, everyone, to Spouting Off. This is Karen Kettling, your host. And I am pleased to have on the line with me a friend and a really smart person, Professor Robert Nadelson. He heads up the Institute, the Independence Institute's Constitutional Studies Center, and also the Article 5 Information Center, which we'll find out more about the Article 5 Information Center. He's a nationally known constitutional scholar, author, and his research into history and legal meaning of the Constitution has been cited repeatedly at the U.S. Supreme Court, Federal Appeals Court, State Supreme Courts, and a whole lot more. If I read his whole bio, we won't have time to chat. The one thing I want to say that I know for a fact, and a lot of people don't, is that when the esteemed Mark Levin brought up the whole idea of an Article 5 convention, his consultant who brought it to his attention, if I'm not mistaken, is our friend who's on the line, Rob Nadelson. Thanks for joining us on Spouting Off.
I'm thrilled to be with you, Karen.
Well, great, great. And I just love being able to run stuff past you when I've written something because you always have such a wonderful critical eye. You're a regular contributor of the Daily Caller, and off air right before the show, right before you came on, you told me about your latest column, and it says, I will read the headline, "Would Elizabeth Warren be at Harvard if she'd been honest about being white?" Oh, that's a good one. Everybody can find that at the Daily Caller. It just came out yesterday in the opinion section. Tell us about this piece and why you decided to write it.
As you know, Karen, I was a law professor for 25 years and had a lot of experience in that particular environment. It was hard for me to get a job initially because I appear to be a white male. It's not fully true, but we'll come to that in a minute. And the male part's true.
Well, unless you identify as a schnauzer, I don't know.
Let's go. leave
you
that
can do that today, side. You know. Yeah.
And, okay. And in addition to that, I had had over a decade of practical experience practicing law. And what I found out was that when law schools hired people, they tended not to be looking for people who had very much practice. About 40% of the law professors hired my year had never practiced law at all, even though that's what they're supposedly teaching students to do. And the other 60% had an average of 3 or 4 years. Mm. In addition to that, I was warned that I would have a hard time getting a job because I was a white male and that they were in the mode of hiring from political correct groups. Well, of course, Elizabeth Warren sought a law professorship right after she came out of Rutgers Law School, and she wound up making an astronomical ascent up the ladder. She started off as almost as soon as she came out of law school, she started teaching part-time at Rutgers. She then went almost immediately the following year, actually, got a job at the University of Houston. A few years later, she broke into the top 20, got a job at the University of Texas, and then in 1995, she wound up at Harvard. And she did this without any practice experience, no surprise there. But she also did this with what appears to be a subpar record of publication. And so the question is, what enabled her to soar up the ladder so quickly? And it appears to have had something to do with the fact that from 1986 on, for 10 successive years, she represented herself in the chief directory of law professors as an Indian, as a Native American, when in fact we know now she had very little Native American connection or blood at all. And so this sort of fabrication works in the corrupt and politically correct hiring practices that exist in academia. So I thought people should be aware of it. They know it kind of, you know, because they've maybe heard it, but they probably haven't heard it from somebody who actually has experience with the system.
Yes, exactly. And the ongoing joke on social media, and it's a good one, has been that if she's so privileged to be white, how come she had to lie about being an Indian in order to progress?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Now, the irony here is that I actually have some American Indian heritage. It's not a great deal, but it's more than Elizabeth Warren's. And my father's family had Hispanic heritage. The name Nadelson is not Hispanic, but the original name was. And I could have, with somewhat more truth than Elizabeth Warren, advertised that in the directory. And who knows, I might have wound up at Harvard. My publication record was a good deal better than hers. But I refused to do it. I refused to do it on moral grounds because I had had an ordinary white male upbringing and I didn't want to play the spoils game that way. Yeah. But the Elizabeth Warren story illustrates what is going on in academia, that highly qualified. Now, in my case, I wound up staying at lower middle law schools and not making that rise up, despite my publication record and despite a teaching award. And so it does show you what's going on at academia. Let me just put one more example on this. I was on the admissions committee. This also happens at the admissions level, at the admissions committee for one of the schools I was working for. And while we were requiring test scores, law test scores, for most people up around the 60, 70th percentile, we were admitting students with American Indian backgrounds with the 7th percentile. In other words, way near the bottom. And of course, the problem for that is that if you don't have the mental equipment necessary to be a lawyer, you're going to go out there and misrepresent people. You know, you're going to be a walking bomb of malpractice, and the people who are going to suffer are the clients. And yet here was a school admitting people not mentally equipped to be lawyers simply because they had the right ethnicity. That is obviously highly immoral.
And this is all I hate to just boil it back down to leftist ideology, but it is. It's yes. The left has this obsession with superficiality. How it appears it's how it is.
Yeah, Karen, it's largely ideology, but it's partly practical, cynical politics. If you go through if you go through the lists of groups that get this special treatment, you know, Indians are one example, but also African Americans and Hispanics and people who are radical feminists and people involved in the various sexual movements that are popular now. They are all demographic groups that just happen to be mainstays of the National Democratic
Party. Wonder of wonders.
There is a there is a strong history of discrimination against evangelicals in legal education, and certainly Mormons comprise a historically discriminated against groups. But you won't see any preferences for them because, by and large, they tend to be Republicans. So it's largely this ideology, but it's also partly just advancing leftist politics. It's reprehensible, and it is often done at taxpayer expense.
I couldn't agree with you more. Isn't it interesting? You and I belong to a minority that is never seen as a minority, and it's always an enigma. So when you're Jewish, you really are a minority, and yet there are an awful lot of liberal Jews, so it doesn't fit that stereotype, and yet nobody ever thinks Jews are a minority, and most Jews don't want to accentuate that
Karen, Jews have been through this, okay?
Yes.
In the 20th century, throughout much of the 20th century, led by Harvard — Harvard is the breeding ground of all bad ideas — led by Harvard, there was something called the Jewish quota. Now, what the Jewish quota really was affirmative action for Gentiles. The idea was, gee, if we admit on merit, we're going to have too many Jews. They're going to be, you know, there's not going to be enough cultural diversity, et cetera. And so they developed this Jewish quota. The irony of it is that the same people, the children of the same people who kept my dad out of Harvard Medical School on the Jewish quota then proceeded to discriminate against me under affirmative action.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable?
And yet that's what we're up against today.
Yeah. So you were talking about Article 5, right?
Yes. Thank you so much for telling that story. Why don't you tell our listeners, if you would, just to start us off, for those who may not have heard, you originated this idea. When did you do that, and why did you originate this idea of the Article 5 Convention?
I didn't originate it. The founders originated.
The idea, and you said, maybe this can help us today. Am I right?
Let me tell you what I did and didn't do.
Okay, please.
I didn't originate the idea. The idea was the founders, and it has been used. It has been used by reformists for 200 years, not to completion, but the process has been triggered by reformists for years. What I did is I did the basic research and got that research published as to how the process works. And that research was what people like Mark Levin picked up. If you read his book, The Liberty Amendment, you'll find citations to my work. Okay. Throughout American history, the constitutional amendment process has been a very powerful tool for bringing about reforms. That's how we abolished slavery. You know, the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation didn't fully abolish slavery. It was done by constitutional amendment. Women were assured the vote in all states through constitutional amendment. The Bill of Rights were adopted through constitutional amendment. We limited the president to two terms through constitutional amendment. Very powerful tool. The problem we face today is we have a dysfunctional federal government, and we have Congress, which is part of the problem, and Congress is not going to propose any amendments to cure that dysfunction. So the founders gave us an alternative. They said that while all amendments have to be approved by 3/4 of the states, the states themselves can initiate the process if two-thirds of them send applications or directions to Congress to call what's called a convention for proposing amendments. And so that can be used for a whole lot of reforms that most people would like to see. We could use this to force Congress to balance its budget in non-emergency situations. We could use this to impose term limits on the Supreme Court. We could use this to impose term limits on Congress, just like we've already got term limits on the president. We could use this process to ensure that regulations go through a more thoughtful process before they're imposed on Americans. We can use it to downsize the federal government. We can do this, but Congress isn't going to propose those amendments. They have to be proposed through this Article 5 or this Convention for Proposing Amendments, which is triggered once two-thirds of the states demand it.
Don't they have to trigger it on each and every issue, though? Can you just trigger a convention for proposing amendments? And then, I mean, there's been a lot of misinformation about this because people think, well, if that's true, then the left can propose all kinds of things. It would be even worse. That's their criticism. So the left can, how does that part work?
You know, the left can propose all it wants, but you're right. The topics of the convention are defined by the state legislatures that send their resolutions to Congress demanding their convention. So, and the state legislatures generally tend to be much more sensible. I mean, I've got a lot of complaints about state legislatures, okay? But by and large, around the country, state legislators tend to be people who come from all walks of life. They tend to be a lot more sensible than a lot of members of Congress or people involved in the federal government. And they're not going to propose really crazy amendments. They're going to propose things and have proposed and demanded a convention to consider matters that we all agree on, like the fact that Congress should balance its budget most years, or that Congress should be term limited. If you look and you see what amendments have been promoted by the state legislatures, there are 27 of the 34 necessary states have demanded a convention for a balanced budget amendment that's supported by like 70% of the American people.
Once I was going to ask you, Rob, if you've looked at the Colorado legislature lately. When you say they're always so reasonable.
they're always exceptions.
Yeah.
But the reality is you need two-thirds of states to agree on topics, right?
On the topics as well as calling for the convention for proposing amendments to begin with. Is that correct?
In theory, a state could say we want a convention on any topic. In actuality, I don't think any state's passed an application like that for 100 years. What they do is they say, we demand a convention upon a particular topic or a range of topics. So, for example, there's the Convention of States movement that I've signed on, which says, look, let's have a convention to reduce the size and scope of the federal government, to impose financial restraints on the federal government, or to have term limits. That has been proposed now by 13 of the necessary 34 states. So
they don't only have to agree to have the convention of proposing amendments, they have to agree on the topics as well, and you have to get two-thirds on both issues.
That's correct.
Is that right?
You can't combine a convention for an application from a state legislature that demands term limits with one that demands a balanced budget amendment. There's got to be overlap. So what many people are doing now is they're working toward getting 34 to sign on either to term limits or a balanced budget amendment or to what's called the Convention of States applications with the three topics that I mentioned.
You know, it's interesting. It seems to me, because I'm a student of the left. I'm not of the left, but I like to study the left and what they do and the strategies. There is a strategy that is due to be imposed on Colorado based on getting the you wrote eloquently on this subject on pretty much taking away Colorado's vote and making it follow the popular vote. The reason I bring this up is because that's a movement in which they claim it won't kick in until they've got 270 electoral votes. So I wonder if they took that idea somehow from this, because they watched this Article 5 thing going on. Do you think that they're using... I'm not making the question clear. I apologize.
Well, let me answer. I think I know what your question is.
You know where I'm getting at, right?
Yeah. I mean, let me mention it.
Yes,
this
please.
Is an indication. Okay, what you're talking about is the National Popular Vote Movement, and right. they want to essentially emasculate the Electoral College without a constitutional amendment. They don't want to use the amendment process, and the reason they don't want to use the amendment process is precisely because of what I mentioned earlier. That is that while we each of us have complaints with individual state legislatures, by and large, state legislators tend to be fairly sensible, and they know that they're never going to get two-thirds of the state legislatures to sign on to abolishing the Electoral College or to gutting
destroying their own vote.
So they want to use this other dodge. And what they want to do is, as you said, is they want to use the compacting power, the power that states have to contract with each other, to whereby each state would give its electors to whatever candidate won the national popular vote, no matter how disputed that was, and no matter how small that candidate's plurality might be. What I did is I wrote an article for the Daily Caller and basically pointing out that is not constitutionally kosher, that they can't do that under the Constitution. For some important reasons, the most important reason was one that they had apparently overlooked. They actually have had some pretty thoughtful legal minds working on this particular problem, but for reasons that are really too technical to get into in the time we have available today, they overlooked in a very important doctrine that the Supreme Court and other courts have adopted, and that doctrine basically says you can't do this.
Well, thank God for that, because it bears being said that means that New York, California, and Texas, and maybe Florida, would decide who our president is. And the notion that Republicans in California are exactly like Republicans in Colorado is utter nonsense.
Well,
it's simply not true.
Yeah, there are very, very serious dangers. Constitutionally, though, the electors are not they cannot be given away by the state legislature. The state legislature can decide, how they are chosen, but they still have to represent the people of that state. They can't be sold to the highest bidder or to the largest winner of the largest popular vote. The real danger of this proposal is it would send us into a system such as exists in the Philippines or in Mexico or in other countries or in Chile when Allende was elected president back in 1970, a system whereby a minority candidate, a regional candidate, winds up getting the presidency. Our electoral system has protected us against that. But when you've got a system where somebody who gets 36% of the vote can win the presidency, you are looking for a prescription for turmoil. The one time it happened in America, the one time our presidential system didn't protect us against that, the winning candidate got 39% of the vote. He happened to be a candidate I admire very much, Abraham Lincoln. But the result of that was civil war, because he was essentially a regional candidate. We can't count on regional candidates being Abraham Lincolns. And so the Electoral College and the runoff system that we have protects us against that.
And the very notion that the left is pushing this should tell us everything we want to know about the tyrannical nature of leftist ideology, that they would so easily and so, flippantly take away the votes of a particular state and demand that they go with a state that they know votes Democrat 100% of the time.
Yeah.
It's preposterous.
And the founders thought about this sort of thing a great deal. That's why they structured the presidential system.
I think I've lost you.
Do you hear me now? You hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The founders thought about this a good deal, and that's why they they balanced a whole lot of factors, and that's why they structured the constitutional system the way they did. They didn't want a few states or a few cities to determine who was elected president. That's not only wrong, it's also prescription for chaos.
You're breaking up just in time to give me the notice that it's about time to wrap up. We didn't get to Article 5 in as much detail as I'd like. You're a wealth of information. I'm glad we got to touch on these very critical, important issues. How can people find you, read your stuff, contact you? Are you on Twitter? Are you on Facebook and all that?
Best way is to go to independenceinstitute.org and just click on Constitution. And also, I have a book out, two books out, available from Amazon. One is called The Law of Article 5, and the other is called The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said It Meant, both available for ridiculously low prices on Amazon.
Well, thank you so much, Rob Nadelson. You got it done before we lost your connection altogether. We will definitely have you back on again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Karen.
My pleasure. And he's really a valuable guy. I mean, valuable knowledge that he has. Plus, he's a really, really nice guy, too. That's just about all the time we have left on this edition of Spouting Off. Thank you to Doug and Don, my producer, and BBS Radio, and HW, the guy with the IQ greater than that of a small soap dish. And tune in next week, next Tuesday, 2 p.m. Mountain, 4 p.m. Eastern, when we'll have all kinds of more things to spout off about here on Spouting Off.